It's my privilege to give this talk here today in order to inspire, in order to elucidate and encourage according to the teachings of the Buddha. I travel to many countries in the Western world and also in South and Southeast Asia, teaching Dhamma, teaching Buddhism. But of all of those teachings which people like to hear the most, it must always be those teachings on meditation. Here in Sri Lanka, that most of you have heard a theory so often. You've learnt it in the Sunday schools when you were a small child. And you've heard and read it in Barnas throughout this land. But what one really needs to do is, having heard those teachings, make sure you put them into practice. Otherwise, you'll be like that person who I've been describing many times in the talks I've given in Sri Lanka so far during my visit. It's a story of the man from Colombo who went to an expensive restaurant. And the waiter gave him a menu. And the menu was printed on thick card and written in beautiful letters embossed in gold. And the man took the menu. He ate the menu, paid, and went home. And having eaten the menu, paid and left home, went home, he left the restaurant as hungry as when he first went in. Now that simile means that sometimes we can listen to the Dhamma, we can study the Dhamma. That's just like eating the menu. If we don't look at what that menu is pointing to and order the food and eat that food, then we'll go home from our temples, or we go home after listening to this talk as hungry as when we first came in. So the Dhamma is the menu, and the main course of that menu will always be meditation. And the meditation has always remained at the heart of the teaching of the Buddha. And as you all know, the Bodhisattva sat under the Bodhi tree where he became fully enlightened through the practice of meditation. And as upasakas, upasikas, monks and nuns throughout the ages have gained their deep insights and changed their lives, mostly through the practice of meditation, through eating the food rather than reading and studying the menus. There was a disciple of mine in Australia who was born in Sri Lanka, an engineer who migrated to Perth. He was what we call in the West a Waisak Buddhist. In other words, they go to the temple once a year at Waisak, and the rest of the time you would never see them in the temple at all. So he had come to my temple at Waisak, and that was all. However, he was working in the Department of Minerals and Energy in Western Australia, and he had an Australian boss who he called the boss from hell. A boss from hell is someone who is always scolding you, always demanding you do more work than anyone could ever perform. And no matter how hard you worked and the quality of work which you did, it was never good enough. He was demanding, angry, and always scolding. He was what we call the boss from hell. And I'm sure that even many people in Sri Lanka have experience of bosses from hell. But a strange thing happened to his boss. In a space of maybe 4 or 5 months, his boss, a Caucasian Australian, changed his character completely. Instead of being harsh and demanding, he became appreciative, soft, and friendly. Now this worker, this Sri Lankan engineer, could do more work and better work with a boss like that. But he couldn't help think, why did that boss change? And so one day, over a cup of tea, he asked his boss, "If you don't mind me asking, sir, you've changed. Now before, if you don't mind me saying, you were very difficult to work with. But now you're such a wonderful boss. What have you done?" And his Caucasian Australian-born boss, said, "Well, you know, I found this wonderful temple where I've been practicing meditation every week. And even my wife notices the change in me. I'm a much more peaceful, happy person. I've been learning meditation." "Which temple is that?" said the Sri Lankan man. And he said, "The temple where Ajahn Brahm lives." And the Sri Lankan man said, "That's my temple." And it was only when he realized just the treasures which he'd been missing by going just once a year in ceremonial occasions, he realized that the Dhamma of Buddhism was far more than mere rituals and mere faith practices. He saw in an Australian man the effect of only 4 or 5 months of meditation to see how it changed his life. And as a result of that experience, that man now comes every week and meditates. He needed to see the results in somebody else before he appreciated the benefits of such a practice. The practice of learning how to calm your mind, to make it peaceful, to make it still. Because if we learn how to calm our mind down in a good way, it has huge benefits. Not only does it increase one's intelligence, a Harvard professor who has spent the last 7 years studying the effects of meditation published a paper last year which showed that meditators in the United States who had meditated for 6 or 7 years had increased the size of their brain significantly. Their cortex had grown. In other words, they had more brain and therefore more computing power. In modern jargon, I say they had more gigabytes between their ears, more computing power. They upgraded their hardware. By so doing, you can see the benefits, even intellectually, of meditation. And there's been so many other studies which have done, which showed that the power of meditation increases one's immune system, makes you healthier, live longer, allows diseases to subside, but more importantly, gives you a great emotional health, a peace of mind, an ability to cope with the problems of life, to have a happier relationship with your family, and also, but more importantly, to have more peace of mind for oneself. And in today's talk, I wanted to go into the nitty-gritty of meditation. Having given you the advertising spiel, having marketed it and said that meditation is important, now how do you meditate? The way of meditation is not that difficult if one can only understand that meditation is supposed to be aiming for a still and peaceful mind. Don't think of meditation as concentration, because concentration gives the idea of force. It's much better to look at meditation as being still and peaceful and calm. Because otherwise people will meditate and they will struggle and strive so hard to get jhana or sowan that they will end up more stressed than when they started. Because that happened when I went to Malaysia to start teaching meditation. People there complained about samadhi headache. And I said, "Samadhi headache, what's that? I've never seen that in the teachings of the Buddha." And what they meant, they were trying so hard to concentrate on their breath that it was more stress than if they were in their office doing their job. And I noticed on some meditation retreats, we take the photograph of all the people on retreat at the end of the retreat when they look so happy. But they look happy not because they've got into peaceful meditation. They're happy and smiling because now they can go home. They don't need to meditate anymore. I like to take pictures in the middle of my retreat when there's still many days to go. And if people are smiling then that's a good photo. Now, if you are trying too hard, you are missing the point of meditation. The path of meditation is the path of going inwards, not onwards. This is not the path of excitement. If you think about it, excite is the opposite of the word insight. At least it sounds that way. Etymologically, that's complete nonsense, but nevertheless, it's not exciting, it's inciting. It's not going onwards, but going inwards. It's not going on to the next moment, the next achievement, the next state of mind. Meditation is being more fully aware of the state you're in right now. It's going into the middle of this state. Being more fully here, instead of trying always to be somewhere else. A person who always tries to be somewhere else is like the old story of the dog with mange. A dog with mange has a very itchy skin. And in this story, which actually comes from the Buddha, that dog with mange had such an itchy coat, it decided to go into the hot sun, thinking the hot sun would relieve its irritation. But it never did. So the dog went into the shade of a big tree, and still it itched. So it went into the water, it went under a rock, it went into the village, but no matter where that dog went, it still had the itch. And sometimes this happens with meditators as well, with Buddhists. They've got the itch in their life. In other words, they're not happy where they are, and they go into meditation and they still got the itch. Because they're not meditating properly. They're trying to get somewhere and achieve something to be where one is. As my teacher said, Ajahn Chah, we meditate not to try and get something. We meditate in order to let go, to abandon things, not to gain things. We don't meditate to gain attainments. This is not adding to the achievements of your ego. This is unraveling that sense of self by letting go of all achievements, of all things we will attach to. In order to understand this, I've given the simile of the thousand-petaled lotus. You may all know that a lotus is a very old and familiar symbol of Buddhism, even to the point that those of you who know IT, information technology, would be interested to know that the firm Lotus in the United States, software company, was founded by a Buddhist who decided to give that company a Buddhist logo, the Lotus. But in this simile of the thousand-petaled lotus, and seen lotuses, that at night time the lotus closes up all its petals and is like a hard bud. In the early morning light, when the first rays of the sun warm the outermost layer of petals of the lotus, it begins to open up. It opens up to reveal the next layer of petals. And as that opens up, it allows the sun to reach that layer of petals and warm it. And so that layer of petals opens to reveal the inner layer of petals, which receives the warmth of the sun, so that too can open up. The petals open up layer by layer only when they receive the warmth of the sun. And you, looking at that lotus, you go deeper and deeper and deeper into the heart of that lotus. We want to find what's inside, the center. What in Tibetan Buddhism, there is a very famous mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. I don't mind using other traditions to explain a point which the Buddha would approve of. That means the worship to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And what is that jewel? You'll find out in a few minutes. What's in the center of things? Is there a soul? Is there a God? What is actually in the middle of these things? We have to go into the center to find out. And this is basically what meditation is. Opening up this body of mind to see what's inside. Now with that simile of a lotus, you will all recognize that the outermost petals of a lotus, the ones which you see at night time, they have to receive the harsh wind and the dust. They are the dirty petals, which aren't all that beautiful. But as that lotus opens up, every next layer of petals becomes more pure, more fragrant, and more beautiful. And that's exactly what happens when you meditate. You're opening up the body and the mind. You begin just by focusing on whatever you're experiencing now. It does not matter how rough, how dirty, how unpromising it is. You close your eyes and become aware of whatever you're experiencing. Usually your body. Then you go inside of that. First thing we have to enter is time. To go into the middle of time, which is called this present moment. As time opens up like the petals of a lotus to reveal the present moment, just now, the heart of this we call time. Very often that we are so obsessed with our memories of the past and our fears for the future, our plans and our worries, that burdens us so much that we're not really aware of what we're doing now. And part of meditation is abandoning the past and the future for the period of meditation. I don't mean forever. It doesn't mean you're always in the present moment, every moment of your life. If I did that and was always in the present moment, I would have never got on the aircraft to come to Sri Lanka in the first place. That needed a lot of planning. So you are not stupid with your meditation. You are in the present moment when you are meditating. Or when you have nothing to do, when you're relaxing and resting. And for those of you who have difficulty letting go of your past and letting go of concern about the future, please understand that the past is done with, it's finished, it cannot be changed. And moreover, you can't be sure exactly what happened in the past. How many of you have had arguments with your family members about who did what and how and when? I have a running argument with my brother about which one of us had a fever when we were young. I know that one of us did have this, I forget what it was, measles or something. And my brother insists he had the measles. I was sure it was me who had the measles. I asked our mother, and our mother said, I don't know which one, but only one of you had it. Because what happens in the past is very often we create the image of the past which we want to believe. Any policeman would know that when you investigate a traffic accident and you interview observers who saw that incident only maybe 15 minutes ago, they will give completely different descriptions of what happened, but they will all be absolutely sure that that's what they saw. We are very selective with what we remember from the past. In Harvard a few years ago, they did this interesting experiment. One of the psychologists went to an unsuspecting student and asked him a simple question such as, which is the way to the philosophy department? And before that student could answer, two men with a big door walked straight between the psychologist and the student. So their conversation was interrupted for a second or two. And once that door had passed between them, they asked the question again, which is the way to the philosophy department? And the student answered. However, what had happened is the first psychologist who asked that question actually carried on with the door behind the door where the student couldn't see him. And a fresh psychologist replaced him. So the person, the psychologist who first asked the question, was not the one who repeated the question. And they varied the switch of these psychologists to see if the student being asked would recognize a change had taken place. And you would be amazed that sometimes you could have a small Caucasian girl who asked the first question, which is the way to the philosophy department, and she would go with the door being replaced by this huge Afro-American male who asked the second question, where is the philosophy department? And the person listening wouldn't notice. The point being is we only take note of what is important to us. In that incident, only the question was important, not the person who asked the question. And so the person who asked the question was not registered in the memory, only the question, which is why they could switch the questioners without anybody knowing. Now this is just an example of what we mean by memory. We only collect and keep the important information, or rather what's important to us, and the rest we make up. Understanding that the past is so uncertain, what we think happened probably never did happen. So it's a waste of time worrying about the past. In meditation we learn how to let it go, to put it aside for the period, so we're not bothered by who said what to whom and how and when. If somebody does call you an idiot, what do most people do when you hear them call you an idiot? You start thinking, why did they call me an idiot? They have no right to call me an idiot. They should not call me an idiot. And you notice they have just called you an idiot 3 more times. Every time you remember that, you're allowing them to call you an idiot another time. When you understand that, it makes common sense to let go of the past, especially the unpleasant past, to drop it. So if they do call you an idiot, they only call it once, and then you forget about it. In meditation, we train ourselves to let go of the past. We also train ourselves to abandon the future, because you don't know what's going to happen next. You may think you do, but every time you make a prediction, it's nearly always wrong. I tell my students, never trust a poor fortune teller. If you go and have your horoscope read or your fortune told, check out that person first of all, whether he or she can tell their own fortune. And if they're poor, they can't tell their own fortune, how can they tell yours? So please, never trust a poor fortune teller. So in our meditation, the first thing we do is to let go of the past and the future. We deserve to be in the present moment. You have to give yourself permission and convince yourself it's important to rest in the present moment. If you don't give yourself the gift of peace in the present moment, you'll find that peace never comes. If you think you deserve to always be thinking of the future or worrying about the past, you can never be peaceful in the moment. So value the present moment. Know how important it is. Indeed, the best way to create a good future is to care for the present moment. This is where we put our focus and our energy. We're going into the center of time. And then we go even closer into the center of time to what we call the silent present moment. In other words, we're not talking to ourselves all the time. With thinking, with ideas, with internal commentary. Because very often that when we experience anything, we always want to give it a name, or have a conversation about it, or take notes, instead of just knowing, bare awareness, in silence. If you want to know what we mean by silence, I want you all to listen to me, at the same time pay attention to what's happening inside of your mind as I speak in a strange manner, because in the middle of my sentences you will notice a number of pauses. In those spaces between my words, what was happening inside your mind? You will find, because you were waiting for me to speak, you were silent. You weren't thinking. You were waiting in the moment alert, awake, mindful. That ability to wait, to not interfere with the process of information as it comes to you, is what we mean by going into the silence. It's the next layer of petals which we open up, because in the middle of the present moment, if you go more fully into the moment, there you will find the silence. If you go even further into the silence, you stay with the silence long enough. It's a strange thing, but for most people, in the middle of the silence, they start to become aware of their breath. Naturally, you don't even need to say, I am now going to watch my breath. You just wait in the present moment, and the breath comes up from within the middle. Like a lotus petal opening up, you see what's inside. The reason this happens, just like a lotus, the sun keeps shining on it long enough, the petals open up. Your still mindfulness stays on this silent present moment long enough, and from within that opens up to see the breath. By watching the breath, I just mean the feeling of the breath as it comes in and goes out. If you follow this method of meditation based on the thousand petal lotus, you find you don't do anything. You don't choose to move from one object of meditation to the next. It happens naturally, just like the lotus petals open up in natural course according to how much sun reaches them. And this is what happens as the breath arrives. And when you're watching the breath, again, your job is just to keep still. Because if that sun moves or a cloud comes up and blocks out that sun, when those petals don't receive the warmth, they close up again. So you go backwards in your meditation, not deeper. But if you are still, just watching, not doing anything, you'll find the mind gets even more calm and still. As long as you understand that the goal of meditation is peace and stillness, you should also understand that any actions, any striving, any doing, any controlling just makes things much worse. You actually disturb the meditation. You can imagine like a pool of water, and it's got waves on the surface, and you want to try and get that pool of water to be absolutely still without even a ripple on the surface. You cannot do that by putting your hands in that water and patting down the waves. That just makes more waves. You just got to get your hands out of the water and wait for the momentum to be dissipated through natural friction, and then the water becomes still all by itself. Meditation is a natural process, and the sooner you get out of the way and let it happen, the better. As you're meditating and you just watch this present moment, if you are still, don't do anything, you'll find that the mind gets more and more interested in the breath. Here I'm making a divergence. There is a natural law for the mind, that if you want to have a healthy, fit body, you have to exercise it. But if you want a powerful mind, you have to learn how to keep it still. Absolutely still. The more still you make it, the more powerful it becomes. And the reason is this. The mind has two parts to it. The first part we call the active part. That which thinks and manages and records and controls, that which reacts to the stimulus which comes into your mind. Very often that's thinking, managing, controlling, doing something. The second part of the mind is the passive half, which just knows, which can feel, which can see, which can taste, which can touch, which just knows what's happening. That's the passive half. Now, because most of the energy of our life force goes into the active part of the mind, We're always doing something, thinking something, managing it, getting rid of, controlling, craving, attaching, doing something or other. Because we're doing so much, our mind, or rather the passive mind, has hardly got any energy at all. We're starved of passive mind energy, which is why we're getting very dull and we don't see very clearly. When you subdue the active mind, when you don't do things, when you create stillness in the mind, the energy starts to flow into the passive mind. They're not being used up in thinking and controlling, in commentating, in doing things. And all that energy is now flowing into bare awareness, into the passive part of the mind. Anyone who has followed these instructions, you will notice that the mind gets more and more awake, more and more powerful, more mindful, it gets stronger. It's like turning up the power source in the mind, turning it up from us being a small flashlight to a big headlight to being a huge searchlight to being so strong that whatever you can see very deeply and very clearly. And you feel that energy and the power. And it all comes from diverting the energy of the mind from the doer, the manager, the controller, into stillness, into the passive mind. Now this is where, in meditation, what we call the piti sukha, the joy, comes up. Because an energetic mind is a happy mind. A dull mind is a depressed mind. And much of the cause for modern day depression comes from a mind which has been starved of energy, all going into doing so much, controlling so much, managing so much, working so hard, making so many decisions, that our mind is tired. And if you could only give yourself more moments of stillness and allow the energies to flow into passive awareness rather than active managing, you'll find all those energies come back and your mind wakes up, becomes alert, perceptive, and also happy. Because when the mind energizes, you get this beautiful happiness. As you go into the breath, you don't need to do anything or go anywhere, remember, that's going in the opposite direction of meditation. You go into the breath, and you come to the stage after the full awareness of the breath, I call the beautiful breath or the delightful breath. This is a great stage in meditation which I am very happy to see people reach. They're meditating and it becomes naturally delightful. They're sitting there watching the breath go in and go out with a smile on their face. And they're so happy to do it. And meditation becomes a joy, not a chore. And people love meditating when they get to that stage. And sometimes on meditation retreats, they keep on meditating for hour after hour after hour, not because they're struggling or striving, but because they're having a good time. They're enjoying themselves. They're starting to experience the piti sukha, the joy of a still mind. And the energy is starting to flow. So in the middle of the breath, you'll find the full awareness of the breath. In the middle of the full awareness, you'll find the beautiful breath, the delightful breath. Back to the simile of the lotus opening up, as you go deeper and deeper into the lotus, the petals become more beautiful and more fragrant, and more delicate too. That's the nature of any flower. And you're reaching the petals of the lotus that is your body and mind. And as you keep going inwards, never onwards, don't go to the next stage, go deeper into this stage you're experiencing now. You'll find in the middle of that beautiful breath comes this wonderful stage called the nimitta, this light which appears in the mind from within the middle of the beautiful breath. That light which comes up in the mind, what in the ancient Buddhist texts called the nimitta, what many meditators experience is like a flashlight put in the front of your face, or a car headlight, or like a moon, a full moon. On a Poya day, this beautiful light which comes. When that light first came up in my meditation, I hadn't got a clue what it was. Now I know, after many, many years and investigations, what that light is the reflection of your mind, of your chitta. Just in the same way that you look in a mirror in the morning and you see your face, in the same way, at this stage of meditation, it's as if you're looking directly at your mind, your chitta, with the other five senses completely disappeared. Those are the outer petals which have now opened, and you're going deeper inside of yourself, finding out what this mind truly is. It appears as a light, first of all. And by this stage, it's a very beautiful light. To get to that stage of nimitta, if you are with the breath, you don't need to go on to any other objects. Don't try and get rid of that breath to go somewhere else. Just go deeper in. Stay with that breath. Go into it. Go into its middle. Be more deeply where you are. Don't try to get anywhere else. No expectations. No moving somewhere else. Being still. Going inwards. And there you will find the nimitta. When that nimitta comes up, it's very exciting because it's very powerful and beautiful. You do get enormous happiness at this stage. And again, when meditators get to the nimitta stage, the real nimitta stage, I'm even more impressed by them, because at this stage they're really having a good time. Sometimes those nimittas get so strong, you get so much bliss, so much happiness inside, that I say from experience that the bliss of such meditation is better than sexual orgasm. 35 years ago, before I was a monk, I had a girlfriend living with her, so I know what I'm talking about. And the bliss of meditation is better than that. And when I tell people that, they get very interested in meditation. There's a payoff there. And don't think that, oh, such a happiness, such a bliss is a danger for Buddhists. We're supposed to be detached. Because the Buddha went on record in the suttas as saying, monks, nuns, upasakas, upasikas, do not be afraid of such pleasure. Develop it, make much of it, follow it. Such as in the Malunkyaputta Sutta, number 64 of the Majjhima Nikaya, nat bhayitabhang, don't be afraid. Ase vitabhang bahulikatabhang bhavetabhang. It should be followed, made much of, developed. Because if you do indulge in those sorts of pleasures of the mind, especially if you indulge in the pleasures coming next of the deep meditations of jhanas, which are right in the center of the nimitta. If you indulge in the jhanas, the Buddha said, in the Pathsadika Sutra of the Digha Nikaya, you can only expect one of four things. What you can expect is Sowan, Sakadagami, Anagami, or Arahat. Please look it up for yourself in the Pathsadika Sutta. This is what happens if you start to indulge in those sorts of pleasures. It's not something negative, but entirely positive. The attainments of Magga and Pala, which all of you are aspiring for, happen if you indulge in the pleasures of the mind. That's why the Buddha once said, this path of meditation is not a path of groaning, where you groan and moan. The path of meditation is a happy path. In the Dhammacetiya Sutra, again in the Majjhima Nikaya, King Pasenadi came to worship the Buddha in the Jetavana Monastery, the Jeta Grove Monastery. He grabbed the Lord Buddha's feet. And then later he said that throughout his life the king enjoyed so much coming to the Jetavana Monastery because the monks in that monastery were so happy and were always smiling. He noticed the happiness of the disciples of the Buddha. And the Buddha replied, "Yes, great king, that's what you can expect when people develop meditation and they gain Magapala. They gain happiness. The more close you come to ending suffering, the happier and the more peaceful and the wiser you are." So in those nimitta stages is enormous happiness and peace there. But strong happiness and intense mindfulness. These are not states of dullness. When you emerge afterwards, you're not asleep, but you're empowered. Whatever work you have to do, you can do it with more energy, with more precision, with more success. You are literally strengthening your mind. In the same way, through going to the gym, you strengthen your body. And so I love teaching this type of meditation to executives, people in positions of power who need to meditate. And as you develop these nimitta stages, the only thing you need to do is to do nothing. Remember the simile of the thousand petal lotus. Just keep your attention there on that beautiful inner petal of the nimitta. So beautiful, so amazing. You just don't move. In other words, your mindfulness becomes even more still. As your mindfulness becomes even more still and that stillness grows in intensity, so does the brilliance of that light. The Buddha said, Pabhasaran Chitan, the radiant mind. That's what he was referring to. The nimitta stage, where the mind becomes luminous, radiant, amazingly powerful. And now you're experiencing that for yourself. And as you become more and more still, that beautiful, beautiful mind, that nimitta in front of you gets more stable, more brilliant, until it gets so strong it sucks you in. As you enter that nimitta, or rather sometimes it appears that it's enveloping you, you go to the stages of jhana, what the Buddha calls Samasamadhi, the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's what you are supposed to be doing. It's the path which the Buddha followed under the Bodhi tree. It's what he said beforehand in the Mahasatika Sutra. Perhaps these jhanas are the path to Bodhi, enlightenment. Yes, he said, they are the path to Bodhi. The Buddha taught the jhanas as the only meditation he recommended. That's in the Ganaka Moggallana Sutra. The only meditation which the Lord Buddha recommended is these four jhanas. And that's how you get there. But you don't do anything. These are states of deep stillness, deep power, deep energy, where you've left the world of the five senses, you've left all thinking, and now you're in the mind. Powerful, deep bliss, but very, very still. In that first jhana, the mind is only aware of one thing, which is bliss. A piti sukha of a certain flavor. It's a piti sukha, the bliss which happens because the five senses in the body have faded away. They're not there anymore. They're gone. That's the cause of the happiness. Later on, you look back and say, ah, that's what the Buddha meant by the body and the five senses being dukkha, being suffering. Because when they've gone, there's huge relief. In the first jhana, there is still what I call the wobble. The mind holds on to that bliss. And because it holds on, the bliss is slightly unstable. And it's as if the mindfulness moves away. But the bliss is so strong, it pulls you back in again. The going back in is what we mean by vitakka. Holding on is vichara. This is subverbal. You're not thinking anymore. You're not giving any instructions. This is an automatic process of the mind. Nor can you hear any sounds outside. Once there was this young novice in our monastery in Thailand who was listening to a long discourse of our master Ajahn Chah, which went on for hour after hour after hour. And he kept on thinking, I'm only a small novice, I need to go to bed. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? He kept thinking this, when is he going to stop, again and again and again. And after half an hour of this, or 45 minutes of this, this little novice changed his inner conversation. Instead of, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop, he thought, when am I going to stop? And that's when he stopped. When he opened his eyes many hours later, it was early in the morning. Ajahn Chah and the rest of the monks had left a long time ago. He'd sat there and gone into a deep meditation and hadn't heard the chanting to finish the discourse, hadn't heard the monks get up and go. He was in a deep meditation, a jhana. That's what happens in a jhana. You sit there and you can't hear anything going on outside of you. You can't even feel if people pick you up and put you somewhere else. The five senses are not available to your consciousness anymore. You've just got the sixth sense, the mind. You don't come out of one jhana and then go into a next jhana. You just go deeper in all the time. The second jhana is just the refinement of the first jhana. It's just that vitakka vichara disappears. The mind by itself doesn't need to hold that pitisukha anymore. It lets go that last step and doesn't do anything. And the second jhana is where you have such a stillness of the mind that nothing moves at all. That's what samadhi means. The second jhana is the fulfillment of samadhi. And the happiness and bliss is the bliss born of such stillness, of nothing moving anymore. Strange state where you're perfectly aware, incredibly powerful, blissful, but nothing is moving. Like a rock, like a diamond, everything is incredibly still. And you can't move anything either. It's just still, that's all. As you go deeper into the second jhana, the third jhana is in the middle of the second jhana, where some of the bliss fades away. The pity part, leaving only the sukha part. And as you go deeper into that third jhana, you get to the fourth jhana, where the sukha part disappears. And you've got this incredible peace. The fourth jhana, you're just watching peace. Unmoving, unwavering, for many hours. This is going deeper into that lotus. Just like those innermost petals. The second jhana happens when the first jhana petals open out, and there inside you see the second jhana. As the second jhana opens out, there inside you see the third. As the third jhana opens out, there inside you see the fourth. If you really want to, you can go further into the arupa state. But not absolutely necessary, because even from that state, those arupa petals, according to this metaphor, are so thin, so transparent, so delicate, that most people can see through them to see what's in the center of everything, the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Because what's in the center of things? The heart of you, the mind and the body. Why are you going in? You see the beautiful emptiness. In the middle of that lotus, there's nothing there. No self, no me, no mine, no God, nothing. It's a beautiful emptiness in the center of the mind. When you come out from that emptiness, cessation, then you understand what so-one is. You've used meditation to go deep inside. Never think that this path of meditation is just samatha. It is by calming the mind that we get insight. It is by deep stillness that we have deep seeing. We have to find out what's in the center. And this is how we find out. By going deeply inside, deeply within. For those people who still think that you do need to somehow turn to vipassana, that's misunderstanding the simile of this lotus. Just like the Buddha said, nati jhanang apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi jhanang chapanya cha sawe nibbana santike, which is verse 372 of the Dhammapada. It says there is no jhana without wisdom, which is why I'm giving this wisdom to you now, so you understand the path into jhanas and what you need to not do, but not do, to still let go, be peaceful. But also, second line, there is no wisdom without jhanas. You can't get insight, the real deep insights, without going at least that deep into the center of things. But in the one who has jhana and wisdom, yamhi jhanang cha panya cha, sawe nirvana santike, only then are they in the presence of nirvana. When you get close to these jhanas, then you understand what nirvana is. And I mean to do this, to teach this and encourage this, because too many people in this, especially the Western world, so that they can study Buddhism, and they don't understand what it means. They meditate, but they don't go far enough. If you can only get into one of these jhana states, you have some idea of what the Buddha meant by nirvana. You have some experience of why the Buddha said that nirvana, or nirvana paramang sukhang, nirvana is the ultimate happiness, and you're getting closer and closer to nirvana. You understand why the Buddha called that pleasure of even first jhana sambodhi sukha, enlightenment happiness. It's not enlightenment, but it's that close. You're getting a taste of freedom, vimutti rasa, free from this mind which is always pushing you around. To understand what I mean as a last simile, it's like the person who was born in a prison. And the prison had five walls, and the prison had this guard, this sadist torturer, who never let you rest at all. And one day you found a tunnel in that prison, a tunnel which had been built 2,500 years ago by someone called our Buddha. And that tunnel is called the Eightfold Tunnel, and it leads out to freedom. And that tunnel is what I've been talking to you about today in the Panchala Nanda Sutra of the Anguttara Nikaya. This is what the Ananda described, the okasa, the tunnel which leads out of suffering. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That prison with the five walls is like your body with its five senses. That prison guard, the sadist, is called chedana, your will, masquerading as craving. That is the torture causing suffering. And by going through this tunnel, you experience the nirvana outside. That is what meditation is, leaving the prison. But unless you've gone outside of prison once, you don't know what prison is, and you take this prison to be wonderful, beautiful, lovely, delightful. So today I've talked about the benefits of meditation, and I've also talked about the path of meditation. There are many other instructions you could give, but today I focus on the inward path, going in and in and in. Experience deeper peace, deeper happiness, deeper bliss, and deeper wisdom as you go. The path of serenity and insight, together powerful, developing a deeper understanding of what the Buddha truly meant by the path of meditation. And I thank you for listening today.